Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Now you're recording. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. On record. You are?
Mike, record. How can we hear it in there? That's better. Okay, there you go. Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3, 4, over and out.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to go ahead and get started. I have a few remarks to make before our first speaker. And perhaps we can get started at 8:45, which would be, of course, 15 minutes past the scheduled time, but I think it'll work out. I'm Charles Kalb of the Army's Arctic Test Center here in Alaska. I'd like to welcome you to this group of papers on the Alaskan earthquake. I have a few announcements, the most pertinent of which is, please, in fact, it's very imperative that you do not smoke and put your cigarette butts on the floor. You see, it's inflammable. And we don't want to catch this paper afire that's on the floor. I think another thing that I'd like to mention is that there will be a question and answer period, a 5-minute question and answer period after each paper. We urge you to ask questions, but we would like to have you identify yourself when you stand up to ask your question, please. On the afternoon of March 27th, an earthquake shook Alaska to its very foundations, natural, economic, psychological. It turned Alaska into a vast natural laboratory for the study of a phenomenon which only in the past 100 years has become reasonably well understood. Federal, state, and privately supported scientists and engineers have been working at a feverish pace ever since, collecting, sorting, analyzing a vast amount of data that only now is coming into focus. This morning, we've selected some of the most knowledgeable of the many types of scientists engaged in these studies: seismologists, oceanographers, geologists, engineers, economists, and ask them to give you a brief sketch of their findings on the earthquake to date. We hope this group of papers will give you a reasonably comprehensive picture of what happened on March the 27th and our best guess of what may happen in the future. To the authors, I'd like to express our thanks for their efforts, particularly to those who've traveled a long way to make their reports. We have a rather tight schedule. We'll try to keep it exactly 15 minutes late, if we can. So please watch your allotted time. This is to the speakers. We also have here on the podium a flashlight pointer for you. We have this pointer for you. And here is a signaling device for the projectionist. Push this signal device to indicate that he should change the slide, or you may just ask him to, whichever way that you'd like to handle it. Also, another point is this microphone. There is a problem, of course, in hearing. If you move your head too far to one side or another, you can adjust the microphone when you come up to speak to your particular mouth level. Our first speaker this morning is Dr. Ed Berg, seismologist with the Geophysical Institute of Alaska University. Dr. Berg sets the framework for us. His paper, The Alaskan Earthquake, Its Location and Seismic Setting. Dr. Berg.
Thank you very much for the nice introduction. The March 28th earthquake was located by the Coast Survey in one of the seismically most active regions of the world, north of Prince William Sound, close to College Fjord. It is one of the many shallow, large-size earthquakes which occurs around the Pacific Belt. One typical feature of this belt is the Aleutian Arc, extending from the far west through Kenai Peninsula as far eventually as Mount Wrangell. And the next arc type structure is going down southeast, the Panhandle, to Oregon. In a very broad sense, these arc-type structures are well known. The topography is the following. On the outside, ocean side, you have a very deep trench, like the Aleutian Trench. You have the shelf coming up and a volcanic region behind it. The gravity anomalies are high over the trench and outside. You have a negative along the shelf and another high in the volcanic area. The earthquake belt usually associated with such a type structure is dipping inwards. The shallow earthquakes occurring on the outside and the deeper ones inland. The dipping angle is usually somewhere around 30 degrees. The Alaskan earthquakes and the Aleutian earthquakes are somehow particular in the fact that we usually only have shallow earthquakes going down perhaps as deep as 150, sometimes 180 kilometers at the most. This is approximately the setting for the earthquakes in this general region. I have on purpose included the Aleutian Arc and the southeastern part of Alaska and British Columbia, since I believe this forms one seismic region. The reasons for this I will show sometimes later. Let's see. Here is a map which shows the earthquakes in the magnitude interval centered around 8.5, 8.0, and 7.5 over the last 60 years. You see the very large quakes from the west toward the east. The first one occurred in 1906 south of Rat Islands. The second one, March 1957, in the Andrianov Islands. The third one is in March 1929 between the Andrianov Islands and Fox Islands, always following the island volcanic arc somewhere between the trench and the volcanoes. The next one in 38 was south of the Alaska Peninsula. The next one is our Prince William Sound earthquake. And the following one is somewhat out of the last 60 years since it occurred in 1899 in Yakutat. But since most of the geologists are very familiar with this earthquake, I have included it here on this picture. The next one is this in Lutuya Bay in 1958. And the last one along the British Columbia ocean side is Queen Charlotte Islands in 1949. Counting all these earthquakes of magnitude 8 and 8.5, we have approximately one every 10 years. And if you give a rapid guess to this map and you take our Good Friday earthquake out for a moment, you see there's a very big gap left between the one south of the peninsula and the Yakutarak one. So you would either expect to get one between the Fox Island and the Alaskan Peninsula, or between the Alaska Peninsula and the southeastern side. Actually, it occurred in Prince William Sound. Well, we have approximately one shock every 10 years, and Gutenberg and Richter have found for the shallow shocks of the world about 2 per year. This means we have about 5% of the total shallow, large-size earthquakes up here in Alaska. The next question for us now is how precisely can seismology estimate the occurrence of an earthquake, and particularly the large and destructive shocks. There are several methods to know if the ground is accumulating strain, and probably the most reliable one would be making geodetic surveys every 5 years, as is done in California. And right now, I think people in California are scared their last earthquake is overdue and they're waiting for it. If we don't have these precise measurements, there are other means to look into the, well, I want to avoid the word prediction, since we don't know yet that precisely. But we can plot the epicenters on the map and see where they are distributed and see how they distribute in time, how much energy is released during this time, and if we think we have a sufficiently long period of time to be sure what the energy accumulation rate or the strain accumulation rate is in a given region, we could extrapolate and say at a given time, well, we are missing so much. Here is an attempt to plot the number of earthquakes in each magnitude interval on a logarithmic scale for the number and a linear scale for the magnitude. The 2 points for magnitude 6 and 6.5 intervals falling off the curve, mainly since we don't have data enough to make sure nothing is missing. The magnitude 8.5 interval is still lying on the curve, which usually is not the case anymore, since it is supposed that the Earth's crust cannot accumulate as much strain for these large-sized shocks over a long period of time as it can for the smaller ones, mainly due to flow problems. But we see that up here in Alaska, these points fall on the curve, or in a few cases, even fall above the curve. So either we have harder rocks up here, or other phenomena intervening which allow us that the highest magnitude earthquakes still fall on this expected curve. This curve is pretty close to the figures Gutenberg found for shallow shocks in Alaska, slope being on his curve 1.1, I believe, but the average number doesn't correspond to his, since the sampling here has been done over half magnitude intervals. May I have the next slide, please? This is another attempt to see if the data over later years are a little bit more complete. First curve was from 1904 to 1964, including the Alaska earthquake, the last one. This curve only includes data from 1930 to 1959 to have a straight 30 years period sampling. And as you see, the slope of the curve is almost the same, within 2% of the other one, and the number of earthquakes per year, the average number doesn't differ very much either. So, in the considerations which will follow later, I have used the figures given from this theoretical curve to plot the expected number of earthquakes. The average energy release in the total area from the Aleutian Arc through Alaska and southeast going down to British Columbia is about 2.5 billion kilowatt hours per year. Now, this was an attempt to make the same kind of curve for Alaska mainland. This means from 160 west, approximately from the Alaskan Peninsula, going toward the east to 132. As you can see, the points are far from falling nicely on the curve, and I interpret this only in the way that Alaska as a mainland is not a complete seismic region where you can do this kind of sampling. The sample is taken over the last 60 years. The slope of this curve here, if you take the middle line as an average, corresponds within, I think, 7 or 8% to Page's figure he gave us yesterday in a separate paper. This is a curve of the energy release from 1904 on, and the line drawn through the last point is that one which would be the average slope if we include the Alaskan earthquake. This is about point 86, 10 to the 23rd ergs per year. And if you calculate from the slope of the logarithmic distribution of the number of earthquakes versus magnitude and the average numbers per year, the same energy you found about 0.93 for the 30-year period from 1930 to 1959. This compares very favorably together and lies within, I think, the average error in this type of a work. It could be adjusted a little bit. The energy release probably should have been started in 1899 to average with the last big earthquake, excluding it. And we have a few large shocks in 1900 in southeastern Alaska, which have not had a magnitude attached and which are not included therefore, but which have been felt from Kodiak to Yakutagut. I think the intensity on Kodiak was somewhere between 7 and 8. The next curve shows the same picture for the central Alaskan region, and the steps in there are mainly due to the major earthquakes of magnitude 7.8 or over. There is very little energy release over the first 20-25 years after the Yakutat earthquake, and I still don't know how to interpret this fact, but it may warn us against a too rapid conclusion after a very large earthquake to say that eventually the strain release or energy release rate has changed. Now, having these curves, we may have at least two or even three possibilities to look somewhat closer to the question, when will the next earthquake occur? I think the question where it occurs is widely open to discussion still. Looking at the very first map I showed you in Alaska up here, we would look for the biggest gap first and see how close the next two earthquakes on each side have fallen back in time. From the number of earthquakes versus magnitude plot, you have an average number of earthquakes per year, and from this you can conclude, at least from the two curves for Alaska, that you will have about magnitude 8.5 every 31 years approximately, one of magnitude 8 in this total interval about every 10 years, and a magnitude 7.5 or so every 3 years. These are rough figures. I do not say that they may occur every 10 years. There are big gaps, and I think we have to be careful, but these are average figures, and I think a magnitude 8 or so every 10 years is correct. But don't forget that this includes not only the mainland of Alaska, but it includes the whole Aleutian Arc and includes the southeast, going down as far as British Columbia and eventually Oregon, Washington State. Now, here was an attempt to correlate the predicted earthquakes or the expected earthquakes from the first curve with those ones which have occurred in this region. On the left-hand side, you see the magnitude 8.5 interval. This would include every earthquake above magnitude 8.3. On the right-hand side, you see the magnitude 8 interval, which includes earthquakes from magnitude 7.8 to 8.2. For making these statistics, the data are what they are in seismology for the earlier years. I have averaged the magnitudes from all the stations I could get a magnitude report from. Most of the data for the earlier years are coming from Gutenberg and Richtersburg anyhow. But there are a few shocks included here which are not listed in Gutenberg and Richter. Well, you see that for the two big shocks, the one in 38 out in the Shane and the one in 64 up here in Alaska, the figures correlate pretty well. Probably we could adjust that even a little bit better by extending the curve back to 1900 or to 1899. But as soon as we're going to lower magnitudes, 8, this doesn't work at all anymore so nicely. And apparently there seems to be always a little gap before the bigger ones. I had put in the resume the strain release curve also and wanted it to show. But I got this curve a little bit late, and there are a few features in this curve where I yet don't know what they are representing. So I don't want to talk about the strain release at all today. There are indeed other methods for looking at physical phenomena which may occur prior to an earthquake. We know for sure that the crust accumulating strain is undergoing deformations which may be measured in a region where this is worthwhile, like in California. There are tilt changes prior to earthquakes, and in a few cases these are known and investigated, but I had only one paper and a few references to it. In one region at least, it seems that in 80% of the quakes they had recorded, even down to small magnitudes, the tilt meter measurements gave some warning at least 2 days ahead. Now, having covered at least the strangest problem of predicting, well, time is over. I think then I may stop here. I wanted to show two fault plane solutions from the main quake, which are mostly concerned with the tectonic process going on. Seismologists have developed methods to determine what they call the fault, what the geologists call the fault plane. These methods have been started, I think, by Bailey in 1928, gradually being refined. First, they only looked at the fault plane. Later, they looked at the intersection between the fault plane and the plane which is perpendicular to the movement in the fault plane, and this was termed the null vector or B-axis or whatever you want. And over the last few years now, we are looking at the force system which is involved in producing this type of ruptures. And for the Aleutian Arc, it was found that the compressional stress axis is mostly perpendicular to the structure, and the tensional stress axis, if you want to look at them, is parallel to the structure. The fault plane solution for the Good Friday earthquake, for the main shock, gives one plane at least. If you want to consider it a fault plane, is all right. The solution is not unambiguous, so we really cannot tell which plane is a fault plane and which one is the auxiliary plane, determining the movement in the fault plane. One plane is a very steeply dipping plane, about 89 to 90 degrees. Some solutions turn out 88 degrees, and is striking approximately 72, 75 degrees east of north, and this is almost the tangent at the elevation changes, which have been very carefully measured by the Geological Survey in the Prince William Sound area. I have another solution here. Well, I may have that first. The main plane striking 72 degrees north of east, and the small one, dotted one, is the auxiliary circle. There's only one station inside this circle. This is Yellow Knife. Supposedly, this Canadian station is a very good one, so I assume that this circle is relatively well determined. Without this station, the machine would have put solutions out, bringing the auxiliary circle on the other side of the epicenter, but I think this would contradict, in almost every case, the finding that the compressional stresses in the region are more or less perpendicular to the structure. If you admit this solution here, the compressional stresses for this case would be perpendicular to the structure, otherwise it would be the tensional stress, and so I assume this is a pretty close solution. I would not argue here which one is the fault plane. Discussions are still going on, and before we don't have more data, we couldn't do it. May I have the... this is a typical case of an earthquake. Along the usually earthquake belt from the aftershocks, about magnitude 6, we have 56 observations for this one. Not all are plotted on this plot, since a few ones are lying outside. The first choice of the machine here was the straight line giving a dip of 90 degrees, and I think it's roughly 54 east of north, and the auxiliary plane is the light circle to the left. But looking closer into the solution, this would imply that the tensional axis is perpendicular to the structure. So this would, I think, exclude this solution. The second solution and one of the last choices of the machine was the dotted circle, and you can see the solution in geological terms plotted at the second one on the left-hand side in the upper corner. This one gives you compressional stress axis almost perpendicular to the force direction. So I think I will finish here. If somebody else wants to see more of these fault plane solutions, we had about 18 altogether, and probably 10 of them turn out to be relatively reliable.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bird. Very interesting paper. We won't be able to have any time for questions if we're to adhere to our schedule, so I'll go on. If any of you do have questions, perhaps you can contact Dr. Bird later today, personally. Our next paper is a paper by William Cloud and John B. Townsend. It's to be presented by Mr. Cloud, who is chief of the Seismological Field Survey, Coast and Geodetic Survey, San Francisco, California. The title of the paper, Preliminary Intensity Evaluations of the Prince William Sound Earthquake. Mr. Cloud.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I think I should start out with a definition of the intensity that we're talking. now? I think I should start out with a definition of what we call intensity. In the historically used sense, intensity is simply a number that denotes a judgment of earthquake strength or violence as inferred from an orderly classification of what you observe. We use the classification of the modified Mercalli scale, and at the lower level, 1, it would be barely felt. Say at 4, you would have windows rattling. 6, you would have some slight damage. Damage would start at 7. At level 12 would be total damage. So you have a scale from 1 to 12. Now, as pointed out by Hirschberger in a paper several years ago, intensity so defined correlates roughly, if at all, with instrumentally measured parameters of motion. He found, for example, that corresponding to an intensity 5 as rated, instrumental measurements varied all the way from, say, 1 to 50. I mean, there were 50 times the difference in that same rating. Now, the intensity map that I'll show a little later is based on about 1,000 cards sent out by Mr. Townsend, a reconnaissance flight by Mr. Townsend over the Valdez, Anchorage, Seward, and intermediate areas, from reports of others, as many as we could get hold of, from field investigations by Co-Survey personnel, and from reports of the survey ships and aerial photography teams. And for the evaluation, the data was eventually sent to San Francisco, where Mrs. Nina Scott did the abstracting of the descriptive material and the assignment of intensity ratings. Now, the reason for this is that to ensure some continuity, Mrs. Scott has been doing this type of work for the survey for about 20 years. So within the system, a closed system, if you might call it that, the ratings should be consistent with the ratings of other earthquakes going back at least 20 years. The results are given in the forthcoming map. The felt area, or the outside circle, this is a preliminary map, and there would probably be considerable discussion as to the exact placement of the lines. But the outside area is, at least 700,000 square miles is a felt area. In the zone marked 2 to 4, you would expect that the effects would be from barely felt to rattling of windows in that area. In the zone of 5 and 6 is the borderline of damage. Perhaps in 6 there would be light plaster cracks. Then we come to the zone marked from 7 till 11. Now, in this zone, we run into an anomaly, because according to the modified Mercalli scale, there are certain criteria occur in this area that could be both rated as 11 and other criteria that would only deserve a 7 or perhaps less. And that is a fault of scales of this type. They do not separate out what you might call long period wave effects from the short period wave effects. So in Anchorage, for example, you have the tremendous slide areas, damage to tall buildings, which probably on the scale should be rated 11. At the same time, you have the smaller structures and other things that were very slightly damaged, perhaps a 7 on the scale. We are suggesting that the scale be revised somewhat to the extent that the ratings of intensity be followed by some suffix, such as SL or SL, so that the person looking at it could judge a little more closely what criteria was used in rating the intensity. In effect, these maps merely allow you to look at a whole earthquake and visualize somewhat, as a first approximation, what happened as the physical observed phenomena. From there, for any purpose of engineering and otherwise, one must go to the actual description in more detail. And the difference between this is you probably... I'm sorry. The difference between this scale, as you're probably aware, and the magnitude scale, this is based on physical phenomena, observed aspects of the earthquake. The magnitude scale is an instrumental rating. It's based on the size of motion as recorded by an instrument. In closing, the survey would like comments on the scale and perhaps for some improvement of the scale to take care of such anomalies as we have found here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cloud. We do have time. We're getting back on schedule again for any questions, a question or two. Does anyone have a question? I would like, yes, sir. This might be a point for the speakers. Please, if you mention the Fat Cat River, please show on the map where it is. I'd like to ask something, or ask Mr. Bruder, perhaps Mr. Cloud, to clarify this, or Dr. Berg. I noticed Dr. Berg mentioned the March 28th earthquake. This is, I assume, Greenwich time. Is this right? That's right, Greenwich time. When did it happen, Greenwich time? 03:36. Are there any other questions or comments? All right. If not, we'll go on to our next paper. This is a paper by Mr. Wallace Bruder. It's going to be presented by Dr. S.T. Aldermissen, Chief of the Data Analysis Branch, Seismology Division of the Coast and Geodetic Survey at Washington. The title of the paper, Earthquake Changes Alaska Shoreline. Dr. Aldermissen.
That's lower than the headset. Apparently you have to speak directly into that mic, or it doesn't work very well.
One of our greatest challenges in time of disaster, such as a recent Alaska earthquake, is to determine quickly the major dangers, changes in channels, shorelines, and port facilities, and immediately communicate this information to the mariner. Radio, notice to mariners, newspapers, and the chartlet procedure were the media used by the Coast and Geodetic Survey to communicate with mariners after the earthquake. A chartlet is a reproduction of a section of a standard nautical chart showing important revisions to charts the mariner has in hand and is designed to be pasted over the affected area of his chart to provide him with advance information pending a corrected republication of the standard chart. The chartlet procedure proved extremely successful for expediting revisions to charts of the Atlantic coast after the devastating storm of March 6 through 9, 1962. Therefore, in March 1964, the same procedure was adopted to show the mariner conditions of the Alaska waters, shorelines, and coastal areas as soon as practicable after the earthquake. When feasible, Chartlets are published in three stages of ascending accuracy. First, a preliminary sketch from air photographs showing changes of channels, shoal areas, aids to navigation, and shoreline. And then next, a revision drawing showing aid changes, preliminary hydrography, and topography. And last, a final drawing showing revised aids, hydrography, and topography. Results are applied to the printing of each affected chart as soon as practicable. Typical chartlets of post-earthquake Alaskan waters are depicted on the slides, which I'll show in just a minute. The Alaska shoreline changes from the earthquake can be attributed to three general causes: regional uplift and subsidence, land and submarine landslides, and both locally induced and tsunami wave effects. Each cause will be described as its effect on some of the ports of Alaska will be illustrated. Have the first slide. Tectonic uplift and subsidence accompanying the earthquake affected an area of at least 34,000 square miles in south central Alaska, as indicated in red on this slide. Approximately one third of this area, of the area east of an inferred tectonic hinge zone extending northeastward from the southeast coast of Kodiak Island through the western part of Prince William Sound, has been uplifted as much as 42 feet southwest of Montague Island. See if I can operate this pointer off. I don't guess you... I don't know if you can see that. I can't. All right. At any rate, I was going to indicate where Montague Island was, but I suppose I'll have to put that off. The uplift area extends northeasterly to Hinchinbrook Island, diminishing there to about 6 feet. This regional tilting adversely affected many navigable waterways, harbor areas, and shorelines, and necessitated immediate revisions to the nautical charts. Two-thirds of the area shown in red on this slide are about 22,000 square miles west of the inferred tectonic hinge zone, is the major area of subsidence.
This may be a bit better.
Well, Montague Island is right in the center of the red area there. I still can't see it very well with this pointer. I don't know if you can or not. Okay. This subsidence area includes most of the Kenai Peninsula and at least the northeastern two-thirds of Kodiak Island. Recent survey investigations reveal that the largest amount of confirmed subsidence is at the port of Kodiak, where tide gauges indicate a 5.8-foot drop. This is just in Kodiak. Now let's see, Montague Island is right in here, Kodiak down here, and Hinchinbrook. Well, I guess you'll just have to get your own map. Okay. Where is that? Oh. Not sure that was worth it. Immediately after the earthquake, one of the first concerns of the Coastal Geodetic Survey was the revision of nautical charts to facilitate the safe movement of ships. First priority was given to the U.S. Coast Guard Coast and Geodetic Survey Air Photographic Mission, flying over affected areas and recording the damage. This mission uses a Coast Guard DC-4 aircraft, as you see here in the slide. On April 4, only 8 days after the earthquake, Aerial photographs were made of the ports of Kodiak, Seward, Anchorage, Whittier, Valdez, and Cordova. On April 21st, only 25 days after the earthquake, chartlets of these vital ports were published based on these photographs. Copies of these chartlets were immediately airmailed to Coast and Geodetic Regional and Field offices on the West Coast and to Alaska. Copies also appeared in newspapers and in the weekly notice to mariners. These ports play an important part in the economy of the state of Alaska. Therefore, immediately following the earthquake, the Coast Survey diverted two major survey vessels to the disaster area to concentrate first on locating clear channels to these ports, marking dangers to navigation, and assisting the Coast Guard to relocate aids to navigation. The ship you see here is the Surveyor. At the time of the earthquake, it was doing oceanographic surveys, engaged in oceanographic surveys in the Central Pacific. And she arrived at Kodiak on Tuesday, April 2nd. The Pathfinder, diverted from making surveys in the Hawaiian Islands, arrived at Seward on April 10. Two smaller vessels also were ordered to sail immediately, the Hodson to Prince William Sound and the Lester Jones to Glacier Bay. In this slide, which is a little bit confusing because north is more or less at an angle, what we have plotted here, and I don't think you'll be able to get too much out of this slide, what is plotted here are contours of uplift in the Prince William Sound, Kodiak area, based on tide gauge information. The largest amount of uplift that we think was caused by the earthquake was located by the Surveyor off Montague Island. And this was about 40 to possibly 50 feet. An uplift at 31.5 feet is shown for McLeod Harbor, which is on Montague Island. At Cordova, where the harbor is now 6 to 8 feet shallower than before the earthquake, all floating aids to navigation were found to be out of position. An inferred subsidence trough of approximately 6 feet extends from a point south and west of Kodiak Island, northeasternly through Prince William Sound, and thence easternly to an undetermined point east of Yakutaka. The port of Valdez is an example of shoreline changes attributed to submarine landslides. The town of Valdez is situated on an alluvial fan of unconsolidated sediments that is built out into the head of the deep, steep-sided fjord of Port Valdez. Prior to the earthquake, the seaward slope of the alluvial fan was about 15 degrees near the shoreline. The shaking apparently induced precipitous failure of the unstable water-saturated alluvium, and a slice 4,000 feet long and 600 feet wide that included the dock area slid seaward. This, of course, is a slide before the earthquake, and the next slide is a photograph after the earthquake from about the same position. On the right side of this slide, you see how the Port of Valdez was shown on the Coast Survey chart 8519 prior to the earthquake. On the left is the post-earthquake chartlet showing changes at the port. Depths were found to be 50 to 150 feet deeper than before. Good examples of shoreline changes attributed to locally induced waves and tsunami wave effects are the communities of Seward, Whittier, Valdez, and Kodiak. Although this aerial photograph of Seward was taken some years before the earthquake, it shows the general layout of the port. This is, of course, a photograph of Seward a few days after the earthquake. And you can see the general destruction of the port facilities. On the right, you see Seward as charted prior to the earthquake, and on the left is the post-earthquake chartlet showing the changes as compiled from aerial photographs. This is an aerial photograph of Whittier, and this also is a photograph taken some years before the earthquake. And this photograph, not quite so good as the others because of the snow, but once again shows the destruction of the dock facilities. Once again, you have the chartlet constructed. In the lower section here, you have the chart before the earthquake, and the chartlet is at the top, showing the what is left of the facilities. Even though revisions have been published for the most severely damaged port areas and channels, an intensified program of hydrographic surveying is required in order to provide the necessary safety to navigation. This slide represents typical track sounding lines or profiles in the Gulf of Alaska, which extend from near shore to the bottom of the Aleutian Trench and include towing magnetometer profiles, gravity and echo, and geological echo probe measurements. The effect of uplift, submergence, submarine landslide, and shifting of shoals from the forces of tidal waves must be accurately charted, and support of this effort is required from photogrammetric, geodetic, and oceanographic groups. The 34,000 square mile area, indicated in red, represents not only the area most affected by tectonic uplift and subsidence accompanying the recent earthquake, but also the area where an unparalleled amount of long-range research is currently underway. All related agencies are united in their efforts to improve and fully exploit man's understanding of earthquakes and of possibly predicting tectonic uplift and someday perhaps predicting the occurrence of earthquakes. Barnacle studies and evaluation of hundreds of questionnaires, as Mr. Cloud discussed, tide gauge data, levels, triangulation, aerial photographs, hydrographic surveys, and other specialized scientific and engineering programs are included in this long-range program. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Algermissen. We are on schedule. If there are any questions, we could perhaps...
This is the end of this tape. The reverse side of this tape is blank. End of this tape. The reverse side of this tape is blank.